Oh, I was going to speak, wasn't I?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Walker.
We had a motion on the panel here for the adoption of the dash two amendments to the 2498.
We adopted those.
Yes, I had offered those.
Yes, and we have adopted the dash two.
No.
No, we did not.
No, we have not adopted.
We didn't? Okay, any objection to the dash twos? Hearing none, the dash twos are adopted. Now we've adopted the dash two.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt House Bill 2498 as amended with the dash twos, and that we send it to
Ways and Means
with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Walker has moved House Bill 2498 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Let me say that, first of all, thank you, committee. This is, I think, groundbreaking work that this group is going to be doing. I think nobody else in the country is doing this, and I think a lot of states will be looking at Oregon. So we do look at this with the gravity it deserves. And I know that the Speaker and the Senate President, when we sit down to decide who should be on the task force, will take it with with that level of gravity. Call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative Morrison?
Aye.
Representative Ferrari?
Aye.
Representative Montanson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Farmer?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2498, having received the required majority, is declared passed.
Mm-hmm.
John, did your person have to leave?
Yeah, okay.
Got two more? Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3268.
You closed the work session, Mr. Chair.
I'll close the work session on 2498 and then open a work session on 3268.
Diane? 2260.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 3268 defines a speech-language pathology assistant. It requires that the licensure of speech-language pathology assistants and direct the State Board of Examiners for speech-language pathology and audiology to establish that licensing system. This bill was heard the 3rd of April of this last month. We have amendments. I gave you dash two amendments. I've spent a lot of time with them, but at my initial summary of them, I see they add the certificate requirement for persons practicing as a speech pathology assistant to the bill. They specify their requirements for obtaining a certificate, and they declare responsibilities of the speech language pathologist who would use the assistant. They also add reciprocity to the board so that the board may certify speech language pathology assistants from another state that has comparable requirements. And it allows certification requirements to be satisfied with documentation of education and experience. And after looking at these, it does detail some of the responsibilities of the State Board of Examiners.
And for the committee's information, it was at the request of the chair that this become a certification rather than licensure, and part of that is to keep the status of licensure for the frontline care providers and certification for those who are assisting the frontline care providers. So I thought that was a necessary line of demarcation.
In our last meeting, members, Representative Monis Anderson, you were interested in having somebody from an ESD or school testify, and I understand that that's available for you.
Good. Come on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association, and we appreciate this opportunity to answer questions you might have about House Bill 3268. I have with me today Frank Bender from Portland Public Schools, who was a speech-language pathologist there, also chairs our organization's public schools committee. I don't know, I'm waiting for Dr. John Tracy, who heads the rehabilitation department at Salem Hospital, who has been instrumental in putting together the training programs and has been working on this for a number of years to develop an assistant certification program. So Mr. Bender would be happy to answer questions related to how this could work in an education setting. There are many school districts around the state who are utilizing assistants and effectively utilizing assistants. And of course, as we testified on the third, there is no standards yet established. Some assistants are providing direct treatment services, and we believe that there needs to be some standards established in those circumstances. So we're here to answer questions on how this would really work.
Senator Sanderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My greatest concern is many of our students that are in our special ed classification in at least Gresham Barlow have speech and language difficulties. So there are many people, including probably volunteers and aides, that are coming in because there's no way we have enough staff. And the way I read this, that is that a person may not perform the duties of a speech language pathology assistant. And my greatest concern is then that even if it's just to have, I'm just very concerned that the needs of our children who have speech and language difficulties would therefore not be able to get services because we wouldn't be able to have anyone do any of these duties. So if you could respond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, I might respond first and then Mr. Bender can, but I want to show you specifically in the bill how we've tried to address those issues, and there are two different places in the amendments, which are really the bill now. The first, if you'll notice on page 2, starting at line 8, where we talk about educational assistant, many of the services now provided are provided by educational assistants who are defined in the statute. So these amendments really are at the request of school districts to make sure they have total flexibility for people who are not providing treatment services but can assist the licensed person in providing non-treatment service, record keeping, clerical type duties. This provides that type of provision. The second, I would note the grandfather clause on that same page starting at line 20, where people whose experience and education would allow them to be certified under the requirements established by the board, these people would be brought in. And that has been the concern of a number of school districts, so we're trying to address the issues that way. And I'll let Mr. Bender comment from his experience in Portland Public Schools.
I understand what Representative...
Could you identify yourself?
Frank Bender, Portland Public Schools.
Thank you.
And Representative Monis Anderson. Chairman Cruz is not there. I understand your concern about the students not being, not receiving the amount of services that might be dictated on their individual education plan. Part of our concern in regards to this bill is that we want qualified people to provide that treatment to those students that need it. Sitting on the OSHA board, the Oregon Speech and Hearing Board, as the public school chairperson, I hear from people all across the state and know that in some school districts, those people that are functioning as assistants aren't getting any type of direct supervision from licensed personnel. It's very likely, and I know it happens, that there are people providing services that they're not really sure what they're doing. And so that's part of our concern, that we have people in there that have proper training to deliver those services for those students that have specific needs.
A follow-up? Have you talked with COSA and OSDA, and I was wondering what their NESD, what is their response to this? Do they have a position?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, they would, of course, have to come tell you their position, but we have been working with them on these amendments. Unfortunately, my person who was here who had to leave is the Deputy Superintendent of Willamette ESD, and she worked to develop the amendments that you see before you, and we have shared them with School Boards Association and COSA and have not heard any objections to the direction we're taking.
If I can respond to that too, Mr. Chair and Representative Monson-Anderson, I think you're going to probably see this very looked upon favorably from school district administration, ESD administration, because the nature of the issue is there are not enough licensed speech pathologists available to service the growing needs of our students. And so I think that by providing another avenue to provide more treatment, and I think this will provide more treatment time and quality service time for our students, they're going to be very pro this position. I think there may be a few speech pathologists that you would hear that would say that they may not be supportive of this, but I think some of that has to do with just be fearful of change, not quite understanding how the service model may change to benefit the student.
So to become certified, they will need to then take a training, pay a fee, or just pay a fee. Could you, with the amendment, does it change that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Monson-Anderson, the Board of Examiners for Speech Pathology and Audiology will determine the criteria. And as I think I mentioned in my testimony on the 3rd, there are 27 states that have established this level of certification. Sometimes it's called registration, sometimes licensure. So there are many models to follow. Dr. John Tracy, who was plugging his parking meter and has arrived now, has been working on this for a long time and has developed with Chemeketa Community College the training program that is being used in Salem Public Schools and I think other public schools around the state, because they have been able to use the distance learning model to send that training around. But there are criteria that exist from a national level. The American Speech and Hearing Association has criteria, and there are a lot of other states that have developed criteria. So we think that there are models out there that our own local Board of Examiners can develop that would provide protection to the public and allow people to be certified in this field.
Questions?
Just one other then. So the training could be obtained through their local community colleges, or still a little bit confused?
All right, Dr. John Tracy, Salem Hospital. As John has said, I've been working on this for a number of years and am participating with Chemeketa now to finalize the training program. We've kind of verbaled the training program out in bits and pieces. And one of the big issues for us in the state association was to make sure that people had access throughout the state. And so right now we're delivering over video teleconferencing some of the courses. And so basically we see Chemeketa as the institution to finalize the training program and offer it in other areas. The other plan we have is to use supervisors who are speech language pathologists who are licensed by the state to supervise these assistants in the local areas. So one of the things we are trying to avoid is the lack of a planned development of a little program here that isn't quite complete, and a little program in the north that isn't quite complete, and one in Salem that is complete, and the two aren't very strong, but the one in Salem's strong. I think we're getting there. And the other thing is the access to the eastern side of the mountains, and we're tackling that too.
Have you discussed this with the Department of Ed? Because I usually would think that the Department of Ed would, I feel the legislature's a little micromanaging a little bit, that the standards should be set by Department of Ed and implemented through that process. So can you explain what communication has been done through the Department of Ed?
Ms. Chair, Representative Monson-Anderson, we have members of our own profession that work in the Department of Education. We also feel in the profession that it's best to have our profession, our own board, set the standards for our profession rather than a board that's not a part of our profession. The Department of Education, as far as I know, is highly supportive of this. In fact, they have said, why doesn't the Oregon Speech and Language Hearing Association do something to help trade assistance in the state? We think it's a needed service. So we have stepped forward based on that input as part of the need to develop the legislation.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I note that the implementation date for this bill, with some exceptions, is beginning of next year, and then the grandfather clause expires the year after. Do you believe, and I'll direct this at any of you, do you believe that the licensing board, the board of examiners, is going to be able to adopt the rules that they need in enough time to implement the grandfather clause? And I guess maybe as a piece of this, it would be useful for me if you would describe in very general terms what this training program is, how long it is, what it covers. Again, very general.
If I can answer the first part, Mr. Chair, representing Barnhart, the operative date in the act would be January 2nd, 2003, and that was at the request of the licensing board to give them enough time, because they have a lot of duties here in adopting rules and developing the criteria. So we believe that once that's adopted in 2003, there is that one-year window to grandfather people, and we believe that is sufficient. I'll let Dr. Tracy talk about the components of the training program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the components of the program is basically, it's a two-year program, and what our licensure bill is looking for, satisfaction of the equivalent rather than to do it as a degree. You have to have this degree to get the certification, and basically it's approximately half general education and half technical education.
Any other questions?
One other.
Yes, Representative Mona.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It states here it's the State Board of Examiners, and so there's obviously we're going to need many, many, many more speech pathologist assistants than there are speech pathologists. So what kind of fiscal impact is this going to have, and will not one be needed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miles Anderson, the Board of Examiners has submitted, I think, a fiscal to legislative fiscal. I don't know if you have.
Not seen anything at this time.
I can give you what they have informed us. The Board of Examiners has informed us as to the fiscal impact. Since the bill does not take effect until January 1st, 2003, they are anticipating that their expenditures will be $250. Part of that is to have a computer programmer come in and set up the registration or the certification database for their program, and they have factored in Attorney General time to review the administrative rules that are being developed. They anticipate that the revenues coming into the system will be about $5,500 during this biennium, and approximately $10,000 the next biennium, 2003-2005 biennium, from license fees. We don't know how many assistants would be certified under this. We are anticipating between 100 and 150 at this point, but we aren't sure. So I don't think at this point they will outnumber speech-language pathologists. There are approximately, I think, 1,200 speech-language pathologists licensed in the state.
Any other questions? The chair would entertain a motion on the desk to amend. So moved. Representative Morissette moves the desk to amendment to House Bill 3268. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Yes, I would move House Bill 3268 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves House Bill 3268 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Morissette Anderson.
I really feel that the intent of this bill is very, very good. I just have a couple of phone calls that I need to make. I will be voting no, but with probably voting yes on the floor. But I just am uncomfortable with a couple of issues, and so I'm going to make those calls, but I think that it's fine, primarily to my own school district. And I'm sorry I didn't do that before today.
Any other discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Well, I note that the way this bill becomes effective, it becomes effective immediately before the next regular session of the legislature. And I think that if the board finds that there's some significant problem with it, they'll let us know and we can make a change.
And I think we can also expect a different funding package in the next biennium than there is this biennium.
That would be likely.
But since I'm term limited, that's your job. Any other discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative
May. Aye.
Representative
Gerard. Aye.
Representative Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Hawkins.
No.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. House Bill 3268, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Volunteers to carry.
I think you ought to give it to Representative Carlson to carry. Give it a Crummel.
Representative Crummel will carry. That's his penalty for not being here. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3268. Thank you very much. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2507. So our first one won't have to hang around any longer. Bam.
Okay.
Which bill?
Chair Cruz, members of the committee. Okay. In its good form, unamended, House Bill 2507 directs the Oregon Department of Human Services to apply for a waiver to implement a requirement that Oregon health plan participants be an Oregon resident. It requires that the Oregon health plan participant be an Oregon resident and establishes the type of information that may be used to establish proof of Oregon residency. After some discussions with OMAP, I, in my background information and summary, gave you information that Healthcare Financing Administration, also known as HCFA, already provides that Medicaid services are to be provided to eligible residents of a state, including residents who are absent from the state, and declares that the state of residence is the state where the individual is living with the intention to remain there permanently or for an indefinite period, or where the individual is living which he or she entered with a job commitment or seeking employment, whether or not currently employed.
However, that has nothing to do with the bill.
Oh. There are amendments. Well, that speaks to the residency issue of the original bill. Amendments to the bill would remove the residence requirement of the original bill and make it a requirement that a person at the time of application show that they have been without health insurance coverage for 6 months. This would not apply to children, pregnant women, and the elderly. This bill does not go away to me.
Do we have an amendment?
I haven't got the amendment.
I don't have any amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, trust us.
Yeah, no way. I'm not just sort of trickling into my office all day. So I'm sorry. Yes, I have them prepared for you, too.
Oh, that was helpful. Well, gosh, you know, you guys
just thought I'd lost it.
No. I actually just received.
I can't believe you guys actually have to have the printed thing in front of you.
I received them just before today.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. Colleagues, let me kind of. These are my amendments, and.
So this is all deleted.
And what this has to do with. This is almost premature, but not really, because we're going to be hearing the Medicaid waiver bill on Thursday.
Okay.
So where we are coming at with this new design of our healthcare system, where we're going to basically be having parallel tracks of private funded health insurance and public assisted health insurance. One of our concerns became that people would have a tendency to want to be portable between the two systems, and for some system stability, by having a 6-month disconnect, if they decide to go off one to go to the other, it would be a decision that they would have to have solid reasons for making that choice. And what we are finding as we go through the system remake is there are going to be decision points for us as the plan and for those who are participants of the plan that may not be the easiest thing in the world, but necessary for the system to be designed and operate the way we're hoping it will. So this,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I just have a question. May I ask a question in the middle of all this? What problem is this trying to fix? I'm having trouble understanding that.
Not one that actually exists at the moment. But Hirsch, why don't you come up? We've had a work group working on how we're going to, on the redesign of the healthcare system in Oregon. Mr. Crawford's been part of it, I've been part of it, and this is one of the points of discussion that we have had. Maybe I'll let Hirsch kind of speak to it from NOMAP perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, the Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Just to make it clear what this amendment actually does, first of all, it does not apply to individuals who are referred to in Medicaid law as categorical eligibles. Those are the elderly and disabled parents and kids in the temporary assistance, the needy family program, other groups of children, pregnant women. We're not talking about those individuals. What we're talking about are individuals who are eligible for Medicaid in Oregon only because we're doing the Oregon Health Plan and we have our waiver. Currently, there is no requirement that individuals in that group be uninsured in order to participate. However, there are some other groups who are covered for health care coverage in Oregon who are currently required to be uninsured. An example of that is children in the Children's Health Insurance Program must be uninsured in order to participate in that program. While it's not a part of Medicaid, but people who participate in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program must be uninsured in order to participate in that program. And the idea in both of those, in one case with the Children's Health Insurance Program, it's a federal requirement that kids be uninsured to participate. In the FIOP program, it's been a part of the design of that program from the beginning. But the idea is that our goal was to try and expand access to care with our publicly supported healthcare programs rather than simply replace private insurance with public coverage. Now, Chair Cruz is correct. We've had a number of discussions about where the governor would like to go with the Oregon Health Plan, and a number of things that have been discussed with that. And one of the things that we have come to realize is that if the health plan is to be sustainable in the long run, we need to do reasonable things to control the cost of the program. And one of the things that is being considered for the next generation of the health plan, certainly the next waiver for the health plan, that will be a part of discussions that we'll have around Senate Bill 2519, will be the idea that you need to be uninsured in order to participate in the non-categorical groups that are covered under the health plan. What this bill does is simply make the plan that we have today consistent with where we think is a very reasonable place to go in the next generation of health plan waivers.
And I will point out, and I think it's true, Hirsch, that it was pretty much consensus in the governor's work group on this concept. So, and like I say, you know, I've been trying to figure out how to roll out the various pieces that we've been working on. Having this come before the waiver bill, I don't know, I wasn't sure when we were going to get the amendments for the waiver bill, so I had a feeling that we couldn't wait necessarily forever before that significant piece, but lo and behold, Mark Gibson and I came to agreement today. I'm assuming we're still in agreement, aren't we?
We are, but I didn't exactly.
Okay.
Holly Robinson, legislative counsel.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Could you tell us who's going to fall through the crack in sub 2 of section 2? The 6 month waiting period?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, because of the way section 2 is structured, it, as I said, excludes all of the categorically needy, medically needy, or most vulnerable people who are covered under the Oregon Health Plan. And it does apply then to those groups that we refer to as our new eligibles. And those are people who could not be covered for Medicaid except for the fact that we're doing the demonstration waiver. There are today about 85,000 people in that group. There are no children in that group because they're covered under categorical Medicaid groups. There are no pregnant women in that group. We refer to that group as having two subpopulations. One are adults, single adults and couples without kids, and the other population group are people who are parents of children. But those children, while they are covered for Medicaid, are not covered as part of the 85,000. They're covered under other categorical groups. Of those 85,000, today there are about 1,000 people in that group who do have reported health insurance.
1,000. So if one of those were to lose their health insurance, they would have to wait for 6 months before they could come into this program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think if we were implementing this, the way to implement it would be to have this be a prospective eligibility requirement, in the sense that what we would say is that after the effective date of the change, people could not join the program if they had insurance or if they had had insurance within the previous 6 months, which is currently what we do in the Children's Health Insurance Program or in the FEOP program. I don't anticipate that we would kick people off the program
right.
who are currently covered.
Right, I understand. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. A couple of questions. I'm looking at the full-time student in a post-secondary education program. Are there already rules set up in the Department of Human Service that will, you know, that are there already rules in that determine whether a full-time student can come under the Oregon Health Plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are.
Okay.
Already in existence.
Okay. I'm just a little nervous, follow-up. About subsection 2, but I assume I'm always worried about people that might fall through the cracks. But you, for those adults who might want health insurance, but they have to wait 6 months before they get it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I think it's important as we think about funding public health care programs that we really try to, because public dollars are so limited, that we really try to target that money so that we reach out to people who don't have access to health care and that we avoid simply replacing private insurance coverage with public coverage. And I recognize in some situations this may be a hardship, but I think it's necessary to provide, if you're going to do it, to provide us a disincentive that is significant enough to discourage people from dropping insurance that they may already have in order to join a public program.
Well, and I'd also say from dropping the public coverage because they aren't sick anymore. And with the assumption that, if they get sick next week, they can immediately re-enroll. Because what we end up with then is people only being in the plan when they're at high need points, and so they aren't helping sustain the system.
I got you now. Mm-hmm. Forgot about that.
Okay. The light went on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Me too.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a very helpful comment.
Well, and it, which is another thing we've been looking at is the length of contracts, which have been 6 months, because that's when HRSA determines eligibility every 6 months, which we would probably still allow. Well, actually, with this new one, that goes away. But in the current system, and one thing we looked at last session was extending the contracts to 12 months for some stability that way. So there are other pieces that are going to play into this. So this is
right, and Mr. Chair, I think the comment you made a moment ago about discouraging people from dropping health care coverage is not something that is specifically addressed by this amendment, but will be addressed, can be addressed in House Bill 2519, which we will get to later in the week, and this does fit nicely with that idea.
Okay.
Any other questions?
That's just
yes, Representative Bonhart.
Without going into huge detail, would you tell us what the rule is now about eligibility for students in post-secondary education institution programs?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonhart. The requirement is that they have to otherwise meet the eligibility requirements for the health plan. But it's difficult to apply a strict income requirement to students because many of them don't have income because they're full-time students. So what the rule requires is that they be either getting a Pell Grant or eligible for a Pell Grant. So you can look beyond the actual student's income and identify those who come from low-income families.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So, so just the eligibility is sufficient to prove that they are adequate to qualify for the Pell Grant. I'm sorry.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, that's correct. Well, they have to meet all of the normal Oregon Health Plan eligibility requirements, and then in addition to that, because they are a full-time student, they have to be either eligible for a Pell Grant or receiving Pell Grant funds.
The clarification was they don't have to be receiving, they have to be eligible to receive.
That's correct, because there often isn't enough money to go around.
Yes,
that's correct.
Right. You don't want to be providing insurance for students who are otherwise being supported by their parents and whose parents can afford to pay for their insurance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chairman.
Representative Walker.
I understand what you just said about being supported by their parents, but there are a lot of students who are not being supported by their parents, but they don't get Pell Grants simply because the financial aid form has to consider the parents' income, even if they're not getting that income from the parents. So, and they don't qualify for insurance with their parents because they're older than the age of 21. So we see students out there who are over 21. They are not receiving support by their parents, but they are going to school, can't get the financial aid, they're borrowing the money. They're getting student loans to go to school. And there's not any way that those people can get health insurance under their own health plan? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, if someone is a full-time student, currently are going to require that they be either Pell Grant eligible or actually getting a Pell Grant. I think the issue you raise is a real one, but if you want to address that, then I think we need to talk about how we want to expand eligibility for the health plan in order to address that.
Just a response to that. One of the difficulties with our current system is there are several points of disconnect. And what we are striving for now is a system where the disconnects will be decreased significantly, or if not eliminated. I mean, our goal and the work we've been doing is a universal access system. And so if we get to where we're hoping to, that issue may no longer be an issue.
And yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know I just have two children that have graduated from college, and through the universities, they're able to get student health insurance. And sure, it's not maybe as good as the Oregon Health Plan, but it certainly covers the major medical. And that's, I think, yeah.
That's a good point, yes.
Yeah, no, actually, very few things are as good as Oregon Health. Another subject. Other questions? Concerns? Thank you. First, I would entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2507.
Representative Morissette moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2507. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Representative Morissette, I would move House Bill 2507 as amended to the floor of the House for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves House Bill 2507 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Yes. Yes.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Montanson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair
Cruz? Aye. House Bill 2507, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Any volunteers to carry this, or do you want it?
Sure.
Representative Mona Sanderson will carry. And I will close the work session on 2507. And colleagues, we are not going to hear today 3120 because Mr. Kafori could not have another meeting and wanted to be able to testify. So I, as a courtesy to him, seeing how his daughter sits next to me in Water and Environment, I said, okay. And because I didn't want to make Alexander mad. You understand that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
I surely would.
We don't need his testimony.
Yeah, but there were some amendments and things like that. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3267.
Mr. Chair, before we leave 3120, are there amendments? Because I don't have them.
There are. I have. We didn't open up anything, so I haven't passed anything out to you.
Well, we could pass out the
that. That would be great.
That would be fine. I was going to ask, but you would move into the next thing.
It does mean that I can read them between meetings.
Right. Yes.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So right now, I'll pass 3120-1 amendments out to the committee.
Okay. Yeah, but if we do that, then how do we keep you off balance?
3120.
Yeah, it just spoils all the fun.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, you've demonstrated quite clearly that the more we stay unbalanced, the better we work, the more we're able to get work done.
I know, but it's
3120.
The concept that we have a hard time getting to from time to time.
Ask a question in the interview,
yes.
Mr. Chair. When we get to the health insurance policy changes, are we going to have some broad discussion about what the pieces are and what the strategy is for fitting them together?
I'm going to close the work session temporarily and answer that question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. This work group that actually, there has been several work groups of different configurations that have been working on kind of the broad thing of this is our healthcare system, what do we do with it? And what I referenced, what's 2519?
Yeah.
Yeah, House Bill 2519, that when I originally held a tapering on it had a lot of consternation from a lot of folks because of what the original bill was. I think that will all have gone away. The first thing we needed to do in all this, I mean, we kind of have laid out kind of a framework, and we will get into that some Thursday. Mark Gibson will be here, and he and I will speak to where the discussions will be going. Now, there's not a lot of details yet, okay? So there's a lot of things that are still works in progress, but the thing that we needed to get done on the very front end was craft what our waiver request Jackson to HCFA was going to look like. And so that is the bill. Like I say, when Joan was in here, that was, I thought we were done. We weren't quite done, but I think we're done now. We have a commitment at this point in time from Tommy Thompson to get a decision from the federal government within 2 weeks of them receiving the waiver application. So it is my hope to be able to actually move that bill out of committee next Thursday, see if we can expedite process, get it to the Senate so we can get it on the governor's desk. You know, I've been kind of holding off on getting into a lot of this stuff because of all this work group activity. We will try to kind of fill in big picture stuff as we can, but we're still up in the air about some things. It's like there's minor epiphanies that are happening on a regular basis, but we haven't had a major one yet. So, yes.
How long are we going to meet?
This committee?
Yes.
Until we're done. We may not be subject to shutdown. It depends on.
I think that's an important consideration.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about very complex topics. And
yes. Yeah.
Expecting rules to do this is not very realistic.
Well, you know,
I remember rules. I resent that.
Same here.
I mean, we're getting into reorg next week. A general discussion at that point. You know, letting the public come in and express concerns and things like that. Doesn't mean we're done with that then either.
Right.
I've heard some minor things, rumblings that people want to do something about prescription drugs, but that may be a rumor.
No.
We can discuss that later.
We certainly can, and we will.
Oh, good.
So, I mean, those are the things on the agenda, and then there's this minor level children's plan stuff, too. So I mean, we still have a lot on our plate. I've had conversations with the speaker. I mean, you know, I think We've moved some good stuff in this committee. We certainly haven't been idle, not doing anything. I don't think anybody could accuse us of inactivity.
No.
But we have a long way to go. So I have had conversations with the speaker all through sessions, and Mr. Speaker, we may not be ready to shut down when everybody else is because of our workload. So hopefully we get his permission to continue working till the work's done. And I think that will happen because it's important stuff and we need to have finished products here.
Okay. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, I will reopen the work session on 3267. Ban.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 3267 in many ways mirrors the ballot measure 4 that actually failed to pass during Oregon's November 2000 general election. The bill establishes the Oregon Health Protection Trust Fund. It requires that all monies paid to the Oregon under the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement and all interest earnings on the investment of these monies should be used to create the Oregon Health Programs Trust Fund. It requires that appropriations from the fund must be used for Oregon health programs that serve low-income persons. There are amendments to this that I'm going to pass out to you now that I did just receive shortly before committee as well. And the amendments actually add a blank percent of the money that would be paid to the state after the effective date of this bill, that a blank percent of tobacco settlement monies would be used to create the fund and that it wouldn't necessarily be all funds paid to the state. So let me hand those out now.
I already had one.
Okay. This bill doesn't have an emergency clause.
No, this bill, I believe, would then go into effect January 2002.
Yeah.
And if I remember
correctly. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Now I need to give one to you.
Okay. Just stand in more step.
Thank you so much.
Okay, percent of the. Okay, there's a blank for percent of the monies paid to the state after the effective date of this 2001 Act. Okay, the 2001 Act, I understand, will go into effect
January 1st, 2002,
but. question. After the effective date, are we going to get part of the tobacco settlement funds that we might be appropriating before this date? Are we going to get it after that? Or if we get it all before the date, we're fine. If we get it after the date, some of that...
Oh, no, the tobacco settlement funds theoretically come in for the next 20 years.
Well, I'm sorry, but we get them in two times a biennium, don't we?
No. Yeah.
Two times a biennium.
That would be annually.
Yeah, well, I mean, when are we getting the last biennium is what I'm asking. What's the date? Be in before or after the effective date of this act?
I think... I think we got... No, it was in... We've already received this year's payment, I think. What, Alan, do you remember what month that was?
We actually...
Okay, right. Well, yeah, you know, 20 years is long enough to think about for this purpose, though.
Okay, but the next payment then will come.
Does anybody believe it will last forever?
Yes.
Okay. I'm optimist.
People like you who will continue to
talk. Oh, very good, Alan.
I'm hurt. You should be very pleased with the fact that you are going to be the one to keep this fund going. That's something you should be happy about. But anyway, my question still is, are we
willing to like take all the
heat?
The effective date that we receive the second payment of this going to be before or after the effective date of this act? That's what I'd like to know.
We have already received more than one. We've received more than one payment already. I think we've received two. So it will, whenever the payment that comes after that date would be affected by this. What we are assuming at this point in time is that by the end of this next biennium, we will have received somewhere in the neighborhood of $320 million.
Right.
Okay? Right. So some of that would be affected or rolled into this, but the reason we put it off to that date was, number one, the governor has already spent a significant chunk of the money on K-12. Number two, we assume that a bunch of what we're going to receive in the next year or so is also going to be spent in this biennium. So we rolled this out to next year so as not to impact programmatic decisions now, but to allow us to actually start developing a trust fund at a point in time.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Is there any assurance that we are going to receive this money before this act is implemented? I'm concerned that there are several programs that some of us are proposing that could be funded out of later tobacco settlement funny money.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I can give a partial answer to that question, and that is that there is a schedule built into the agreement that clearly defines when payments are to be made, and all we have to do is consult that schedule, and we'll know the answer to the question.
Could we do that?
We could do that, but I should also say that while this may go on in perpetuity, we are having problems now with the distribution formula. So, and the state of Oregon is assuming at this point we are not getting our fair share.
Right.
So this is always going to, there's always going to be some flux in this thing. Surprisingly enough, states like California and Florida think they deserve more, I guess. You know, and so that's an area that's being discussed now. So, but I'm sure there is, I don't know every schedule is.
Now, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I had understood that you had thought of having two blanks, one for a percent of the money and one for implementation date, but only one blank came in. Now, is there any reason why we couldn't go back and amend this bill to leave that second one?
Are you looking for a sooner date then?
No. I guess I'd be happy if we understand that the dates, that the money that we are trying to set aside right now can be set aside. I don't want us to suddenly find out that the money comes in later than we thought it was going to be, and suddenly it's tied up and can't be used. This biennium only. I'm not concerned about using
tobacco sodium. I think you'd
run okay, let me, this is from Joan Robinson from LC. She said, a note to me said, I inserted after the effective date of this 2001 Act instead of the blank you had requested, because I could not find a way to indicate that the blank was to be filled in with a date. We don't normally put something like that in a bill draft. Since the Ways and Means Committee will have to have an amendment in any case, it did not seem to me to matter that after the effective date of this 2001 Act is an arbitrary date. So it was done that way because this is the way LC does things.
Well, that's not the first time you've disagreed with the way
that's true.
Representative Cruz, one of the things that I have always been an advocate of putting this money into a trust fund, but this is to go only for low-income children and low-income adults, and I would like to see this also be used for public health, because for public health issues, which it affect everyone, not just low-income, and everyone who is, you know, paying smoking taxes or cigarette taxes, it's going into it, or, you know, or the companies that, based on the settlement formula, that sort of thing. So I like the concept of the trust fund, of not having that being accessible, except in emergency situation, but I think limiting it to low-income individuals, not that they aren't needing it, not that they aren't worthy, but that I think public health is just as important, in fact, probably more so to the general population, to prevent some of the ills that strike low-income people because they don't have health care. And we're talking about some of the diseases that are spread through lack of sanitation or lack of knowledge of viruses or some other conditions that occur due to lack of economic status. So I think that we should probably include public health on this. That would be my belief.
Okay. Let me explain why this is the way it is. Because we've sent bills down to Ways and Means for direct funding from tobacco settlement dollars for various programs, and we've got one that I forced Representative Morissette to amend that would fund county health and county mental health out of tobacco settlement dollars directly. What we are attempting to do with this, number one, it's talking about a percent of the dollars received. It's not all of them. But what?
Doesn't it say all?
No, the amendment makes it a percent. And the Ways and Means determines a percent of the monies received that will go into this fund. Okay? So we're not looking to lock all of it up into this fund. What this fund is designed for is a way for us to assure that we will have the dollars to be able to fully access the CHIP dollars that are available to the state of Oregon and an expansion of Medicaid as we roll into this new health system. So the design of this is to help us with a health care delivery big picture through this, but it does not preclude any of the other things from being direct funding allocations out of the tobacco settlement, which until that thing blows up is going to be a fairly secure funding source because we know what's going to come in. And so to fund out of the tobacco settlement, that the tobacco settlement, we haven't spent a dime of the tobacco settlement even though we've been getting it for 2 years because the legislature never authorized the spending of any of it. Okay? So now we have all this money and we will authorize how to spend it. But one of the things we wanted to get was a secure pot of money to make sure we have struggled for years to try to find ways to access all the CHIP dollars we're entitled to, which are a lot better deal than Medicaid because it's a 71% match rather than 59.8% match. And this is a very clear way that we can get access to those dollars to kind of fill in some of the gaps in this benefit package system we're creating. So that was the design of this. It was never designed to take all the money, which is why we'll let Ways and Means make the decision of what percent of those dollars need to go into this fund to be matched for these federal programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Gerard. I hope that makes sense.
This is, well, and it's a follow-up because it's a freshman question.
would it not be better for Ways and Means to get an idea what this committee is feeling to recommend a percentage to them?
No, because I don't know what that'd be. I mean, that...
What?
In the ballot measure titled for the fiscal impact portion of that measure, it states in here that estimated revenue for state fiscal years 2002 are $11.2 million, and for 2003 are $16.4 million. That's what it states. And I don't know if that's the specific.
That would be income from the corpus.
Interest.
From the interest, that would be...
That's just simply the interest.
Yeah, you take the corpus of the trust, and then you take the interest from that.
Right.
Remember, in four, the only thing you can spend is the interest.
Right.
Now, part of the reason, Representative, for not putting a percent in there is we're still looking for we're still exploring other ways to get chip maps. I mean, one of the things that we have been struggling with is trying to find a way to get private dollars to use as match. We've run into some real roadblocks with HCFA. With this new waiver and what we're asking for, we may be able to use that. So there's several options in this. And so we aren't far enough down that road. And so part of my frustration with all this is we're trying to put together legislative packages in this healthcare thing because a lot of the real heavy lifting, the nuts and bolts of what we're developing are probably going to happen after sine die. And so trying to put together a legislative structure that sets aside boards that keeps it on focus but gives it the flexibility to develop how it needs to develop sort of thing. Yeah.
Now, the way this is written, the next session after you're gone, we can amend this.
Oh, you can...
And get it back to...
Whatever you want.
Whatever. So the question is, have you considered...
Can we get rid of Cruz?
Knowing that ballot measure 4 failed last time, have you considered referring something else that might pass that would keep the structure you think we need?
Well, I don't know, Representative, did you remember last time when we passed and sent it to the Measure 88? I voted for it and was absolutely opposed to it. I didn't think that it was a decision that should have been referred. I thought, you know, there are some decisions that we are hired to make, and I think this fits
well,
into that category.
May I follow?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I guess the only thing I'm saying is that it, with all good intentions of making it difficult to move this money out of there, the next legislative session can...
Absolutely.
That, so.
Absolutely, unless there's compelling reason to leave it there and it's a funding source for needed program, and then it becomes, you know, if we're doing good things with money, it becomes harder for the legislature to just walk away from it. So,
question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gard.
Despite your expert explanation, I just want to go on record as supporting Representative Walker from the standpoint of removing the serve low cost or the low income persons on this bill. I would feel much more comfortable knowing that we have the flexibility to go to any Oregon health plan or Oregon health related program than just those. We have many, many programs in this state aimed at low income persons. Maybe we should give consideration somewhere along the line to medium income persons who may need health care.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This wouldn't preclude that, though, would it? There could be provisions in another bill to take a certain proportion for...
And we've got one coming that does that, and I think Thursday, that takes $15 million for public health, or your county public health, and $15 million for mental health, and then some for transportation, isn't it? You know, and I mean, it specifically does that out of tobacco men.
Well, that's a one shot.
That's a one shot, but that's the best we can do anyway.
But there could be another bill, though, if this one takes a certain percentage, or this program, there could be another percentage to go for public health.
That's it. And keep in mind, there's you know, low income adults. The new remake of the healthcare system we're talking about, people that are eligible for some percent of a voucher in that, it's everybody below 200% federal poverty. So I kind of think,
wow.
So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Couldn't we justify public health because it does deal with those for low-income people? I mean, could you, under your description here, would public health be, or mental health even be excluded? You know, dealing with low-income people?
No, really not. I mean, if this basic benefit plan reaches parity on mental health, then some of that's going to be covered in that.
Oh, I mean in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that...
Okay, the question now is, everybody thoroughly confused?
I have an additional question.
Okay.
Just in case anybody isn't thoroughly confused. If I understand the way our structure works, and I'm not sure that I do, the legislature, some later legislature could amend this anytime.
Absolutely.
Okay. And they could do it by a majority vote in each house signed by the governor. What I don't understand then is why we have a supermajority in Section 2.
Oh, well, there is that.
And what that's for, other than to allow for some political gamesmanship down the road around this fund. And, of course, I ask the question, malice aforethought, since I don't support the idea that we should have a fund that is essentially sacrosanct because the people have told us they don't want one, voting down both of the measures that would have adopted, that would have set up one. I mean, I don't understand what's the point of that language and why we don't just get rid of it.
The point is basically to not make it the wish of the legislature that we totally destroy the fund, that they'd have to have a compelling reason. Just like the same standard to have a tax increase.
Well, I think we just agreed that they could do that with just by passing another law. Couldn't they?
Well, you can always...
They can just ignore this and just pass a new law.
Well, they could, yeah, they could do it, notwithstanding section blah, blah, blah of ORS, or section blah, 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 but...
Yeah, I mean, this either is a nullity or it's a confusion, and I'm not sure which it is, but it certainly doesn't do what it purports to do. It purports to bind the legislature,
mm-hmm.
the future legislature, which it cannot do because it's not a constitutional amendment.
No, it just raises the bar a little higher than normal for the legislature to mess with it.
Mr. Chair.
I
have been persuaded by my colleague to my right over here. Yeah. both mental health and public health, I think should be included with the low income and the children's. I realizing that they could be funded outside of that percentage, but okay. Let me ask another question. If we're only going to fund with the interest from the money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there may not be enough interest to adequately fund
anything
public
much.
Health and the mental health.
Not right away. Not right away.
No, and so maybe they should be left outside of that percentage then, so they would have a shot at tobacco money that is not tied up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess I've changed my mind again. Well, no. In thinking this through, if I could be, if money was there to fund these programs, I would like to see them in, you know, to be funded.
It's not there yet.
It's not there yet, so therefore I don't want them, you know, in that.
Having a false sense of funding.
Security, yeah.
There.
So I'd rather have them go for the tobacco money than that would be available. That would not be put in this percentage, and I would just hope that they wouldn't put an unreasonable amount of percentage
at all.
So. You better hope that Cruz and I keep smoking.
We wouldn't be that mean.
I have a novel idea. In fact, if I have an idea at all, it's probably novel. Committee, I'm going to request that you come to me with what you think we should do as far as the trust fund and what should be directly funded. you know, close the work session, and, you know, I, you know, we seem to be running in circles here and not getting very far. So, let's come up with a viable definition of the fund and what it should be used for.
Could we also include a recommendation for a percentage, perhaps?
Sure. Well, you know, that may be part of your recommendation.
Because I that is a novel idea that you've come up with to ask our advice. You seem to do that more and more.
The question is whether he will pay any attention.
No, I, well,
I have a short attention span and we're adjourned.